The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
We haven't.
What?
Been on this rock long enough to realize they ain't in the business of shooting each other. We did it. Our team.
He's smiling?
Damn right I'm smiling. Because we just got our ticket out of here.
Is over, but we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Post Show Recap Season 3, Episode 4, Every Man for Himself, the James Sawyer Ford flashback for Season 3, and the last Sawyer episode we're going to get until Season 5's LaFleur. On top of all of that, hi, I'm Josh Wigler, and I'm joined here by Mike Bloom, whose favorite episode of Lost is Every Man for Himself.
No. Do not put words in my mouth, nor a wooden rod to bite down on as you plunge a syringe into my chest, Josh. It is not my favorite episode of Lost.
I'm just trying to make your heart explode at the start of this thing.
Well, I'm full of caffeine at this point from having a one-year-old, so honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm on the precipice, and all it takes is a belligerent Danny Pickett to just send me over the edge.
I was drinking coffee at 7:20 p.m. last night.
What is wrong with you?
I had like a little coffee left, and I was like, I could pour it out or I could drink it, and I drank it.
And did that affect your sleeping habits whatsoever?
I went to bed at 1 o'clock. I've been really deep into Animal Crossing, working on, I've talked about this before, if not on this podcast, across many podcasts. I've been playing Animal Crossing, and my island on Animal Crossing for the Nintendo Switch is a sequel to Lost. So the premise is that the island that I've built takes place after Lost. So once Hurley's reign has started, and I've gone hog wild, I've started creating new characters. Because you can create multiple avatars on your Switch. So before I was just playing as me, but I've now created characters for Clementine. Clementine lives on my island
now. Is there a nice account with 10 million bells in her name?
I'm working on it. Gion has moved to my island. She's tending to Bopo Park, named after Bopo.
Is that like Hachi, where there's like a statue of the dearly departed Bopo or one of Bopo's clones?
So KK Slider is the dog who plays guitar that comes to your island, and there's a picture of KK Slider in Bopo Park. So the implication is that it's just a tribute to all of the great dogs of Lost, because there's no Vincent representation. Well, there's some Vincent representation. There is, Jack's face is, embedded in the ground in a bamboo forest somewhere on the island, and there's like a little tiny dog creature that is sitting next to him. So that is, in my head canon, a stuffed animal in tribute to Vincent.
Now, I'm assuming at some point when we're going to take a tour of this island, you're going to be the Ben Linus and essentially take us to the final place, which is the top of a cliff, being like, hey, this is actually an entirely different island. My island's over there.
Yeah, that's also part of the headcanon, is that when the earthquake happens at the end of Lost, when the core of the island is unplugged and everything goes haywire, there's like a splinter island that's created, and this is I've been placed in charge of that island to get it up to ship shape. It's been really, really, really wonderful. I don't really know how we got here. It's the caffeine. Yeah, I was staying up until 1 a.m. doing this.
Yeah.
I also created a character whose name is 4 question marks, and by day he runs around looking like Hurley, and at night he's the Titus Welliver man in black. So the implication there is I don't think it looks good for Hurley. Basically, I'm playing action figures on my Nintendo Switch, and I've been playing Lost 2, and this is what I've been doing in my free time, and it's been a blast.
Listen, it's fine. We're all sort of trapped in our cages, in a manner of speaking, because I hope everyone's staying home. And
this is how I get out of my cage,
yeah,
right?
And you're not doing anything, you know, nearly as destructive as either what's done to Sawyer or Kate, you know, being a bit of a tease with coming out of the cage and then getting back into the cage or having to shamelessly change clothing while Sawyer, for some reason, wants to give himself a boner to try to kill himself.
Yo! Well, he can't help himself. But yeah, if you want to visit my Lost Island, slide into those Instagram DMs at Round Howard or hit up Momenchies on Twitter at Round Howard.
Oh, I love that place.
If you're an Animal Crossing player, and I'll give you my dream code at the very least, so you can just go and check it out at your leisure. Mike, when I said that Every Man for Himself is your favorite episode of Lost, I know that that was an exaggeration, but I also do know that for a long time you have said that you have a story to tell about Every Man for Himself. I forget exactly when we first arrived at that news, but we had noted that Every Man for Himself was going to be coming out roughly 1 year after the launch of Down the Hatch, and here we are satisfying that, this podcast dropping on August 12th, just a couple of days before we release our 1 year anniversary special on 8/15, the very special date in Lost lore. That podcast coming your way 8/15. We're going to be looking back at a year of coverage, feedback that you guys have sent in. Make sure that you do that, Down the Hatch at PostShowRecaps.com. Although by the time you're listening to this, way too late to send that feedback in. So hopefully you've already done it.
Yeah, hopefully Desmonds right now, knowing we're recording a podcast in the future and realizing I have to send in feedback now, taking preventative measures.
Yeah, if you want to send in feedback about, okay, so I've built Geon, I've built Clementine, I've built somebody who's clearly a new smoke monster, and there's a lot of mystery and intrigue around him on my island, and he lives in a house in the jungle that is subterranean, that it's very hard to access. Are there any other Lost characters that I should put on, considering that this is a Lost sequel? At me, slide into Down the Hatch at PostShowRecaps.com. I'd love to know. But Mike, tell us the tale of Every Man for Himself and how it relates to the life of one young Michael Bloom.
I mean, there's not really a story associated with it as much as something like The Hunting Party did. It just contains a line that I really love that, spoiler alert, we will get into. I don't mean to have this, you know, lord over the episode as, oh my God, what's going to be their favorite line? Because I will guarantee you are going to find out and you will be extremely disappointed. That is a guarantee. Much like the first batch of episodes in season 3, there has been a buttload of hype and a mere dingleberry of actual delivery. So yikes. I'm excited to get into it. You know, I think bouncing off of the nothing burger of the glass ballerina and, I don't know, the bad salad that was Further Instructions, I was intrigued to see going into this, because I think this is another one of those episodes that you sort of forget what happens in it. It's sort of mixed in with this group of 6 episodes that are regarded as some of the lowest in Lost history. I'd say the flashback is, I guess, pairing off of Further Instructions, one of the least consequential we have seen in Lost so far. I wonder how much that informs the fact that we are not going to get a Sawyer flashback until, as you mentioned, LaFleur, all the way in the middle. Not even just the beginning, the outright middle of season 5. I did not even remember that, you know, this was the episode with Desmond setting up the lightning rod. And when I did, for some reason, I assumed that the ending of the episode was going to be the infamous "you're gonna die, Charlie," because that's when Desmond immediately tells him that he set up the lightning rod to save his life. But apparently that's coming later. So this is just a big mixture of memories coming into this. And right now we're really trying to, like, separate out the various puzzle pieces that come with this jumble of the first 6 episodes and truly figure out what goes where.
So what you're saying is, when I said at the start of this podcast that this is your favorite episode, and then I went on to say that this is an episode that you have really, really significant memories of, that I was infusing this podcast with a lethal injection of doubt, rather than anything actually accurate.
What I'm saying is you essentially con the listeners.
How else to gain their respect? You con people?
Yeah, we'll put a pin as to whether Sawyer actually earned Ben's respect from that. Yeah. But, you know, it's definitely a tactic that was used. This is definitely the most Ben of Ben that we have seen this season so far in the first four episodes. And it's definitely glimpses of that man who once turned Locke against Jack in the Hatch last season. That guy is finally coming out again in season three.
All right, let's talk about Every Man for Himself, directed by Stephen Williams, written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. It originally came out October 25th, 2006, and as mentioned, it is the fourth flashback for James Sawyer Ford and the final flashback for Sawyer until LaFleur. For somebody who is a character that Lost so clearly loved, like in terms of the writer's room, the crafting of this character, it always is a little surprising to me, the relative lacking of Sawyer flashback content that we get over the course of the show. And in fact, in this episode, I believe it's just four scenes in the flashback.
I mean, which is fine, because again, I feel like the flashback is really nothing to write home about, especially writing a letter to Clementine notwithstanding. So this is one of those flashbacks that I'm personally, especially because, in my opinion, unlike The Glass Ballerina, where the action on island might be a little bit just moving the chains, this one feels like there is some pretty interesting stuff going on both islands. And so I was more than happy to say, yeah, let's get away from the prison and let's get back to actually what's going on in the various prisons, both physical and metaphorical, on the Lost Islands, plural.
I thought that you were about to say, hey, come on.
Hey, hippity-hoppity. That is not my favorite Lost line, but it is definitely a moment that always makes me laugh out loud.
Weird. All right. So the episode does not begin with Sawyer. The episode begins with Desmond, and we start with that Locke swirl, right? Like, it's the same shot. It's that end of Tabula Rasa.
The Tabula Rasa slash, I forget what they used it for. I want to say something in season two.
In Fire Plus Water, when John Locke is looking at Charlie, he's like, oh, I'm going to have to punch that guy in the face. So this swirl, the swooping camera shot, is always either associated with Locke or Charlie, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess Desmond is someone who's going to have a relation with Charlie. I guess it's the swirl of like either mysticism or foreboding. And I guess with Desmond, it's both, because he has powers, but he also has very fatalistic powers, and it's clear he's very much ruminating. I wonder, in terms of the timeline for Desmond, I know that's a very big quotations around that word, but like, how recent do you think he saw the possible future of Charlie getting struck by lightning that he is trying to figure out exactly what to do?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like that's the moment where he's having the flash. Mm. Like, it seems like that is where it's happening, as he's staring at Claire in the shelter, that like he's envisioning what's going on for Charlie. It's interesting to me, is there something that happened during the Locke speech that involved Charlie, that maybe by skipping rocks in the ocean, Desmond prevented Charlie from going to the edge of the water where he would have been swallowed by a jumping shark?
But Charlie's a great swimmer, so I think you get him near the water, apparently he's totally fine.
Well, not in the end of all for Charlie, but I don't really know exactly how it works. But clearly, this is what's going on with Desmond right now. They play it very ominously, but they're just reinforcing this idea of like, yeah, Desmond sees the future now, is what this whole Desmond storyline is about. He's telling Claire, like, yeah, you got a problem with your roof. Claire's like, no. He's like, trust me, you do. You should let me fix it. And Charlie's like, yeah, well, if there's a problem with the roof, I'm going to fix it. Yeah. I built a church before Mr. Echo exploded.
Oof, which, too soon, Charlie. I don't want to bag on Charlie too much. I know we receive criticism for that, but definitely, you know, I think Charlie sort of is walking. I think he's stung a bit from what happened with Locke in season two, as sort of like, I want to be seen as the person that can take care of Claire. The season two stuff is quite literally behind us. I did notice that Charlie starts calling Desmond brother, and I realized that this is a guy that just likes to steal people's catchphrases, apparently.
Yeah, Charlie's just joke theft left and right, phrase theft as well. He says about Desmond when Desmond walks away, he says, that guy's got to get another button to push.
Mm, and I like Desmond. Desmond's got like a little swagger to him, too. I don't know if that's residual electromagneticism and just messing with his body a little bit, but for some reason, Henry and Cusack, like, Dead Zone Desmond has like a little bit of a John Travolta Saturday Night Fever-esque strut to him.
I mean, this is great because this is like sober Desmond, basically, for the first time. Like, it's either, you know, in the first time we saw him, he was kind of insane. Like, he was driven mad by cabin fever. Then we see him at the end of season two and he's just like stone cold drunk the whole way through. And now he's got like time travel brain, but we get to see like his personality shine through in this episode in a way that isn't under like such world ending conflict. So even though he's dealing with dangerous stakes, he's trying to save somebody's life, you're getting just a sense of who Desmond is a little bit. Like, I'm mostly thinking of the scene with Paolo coming up, which, yeah, Paolo, wah, wah. But I think it's a good Desmond scene.
Yeah.
So I like this as a Desmond episode. I think that I'd forgotten that this was a really good Desmond episode. But, you know, as far as... That's something to talk about, too, is, like, season three is introducing, you know... Desmond and Ben are already in the language of the show, but not in like big, vivid ways, right. Like not in like intimate ways. And so season three has a really significant job of integrating them into the main storyline and Juliet as well. So it's really no surprise that as they're doing that, as they're off ramping a major character in Mr. Echo, there's just no way that the writers were going to be able to do justice to two random 815ers. Like, there was just no way that there was ever going to be any amount of room to make Nikki and Paolo satisfying.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more when we get into the Paolo scene. But when it comes to Desmond in particular, I think the interesting thing is it pairs really nicely with the Flash sideways stuff from season six, which is essentially like when Desmond knows something that the others don't know, he has an interesting amount of confidence to him. I wonder if that's linked back to like the I'm going to get my honor back of it all, yeah. Of like when he has sort of is in a position of power, that is where his confidence comes in. And it's not, you know, him ruling like a tyrannical dictator. If so, then he would have like commandeered Claire out of the shelter saying, Aaron be damned, move down the damn beach. But right. I think the way that he approaches things, knowing how things will go, even as fatalistic as they may be, is definitely a different attitude than, to your point, Desmond, like, being so anxiety-ridden when Jack and Locke and Kate go down in the hatch. I also wonder how much of it, you know, Desmond thought he was going to die in turning that failsafe key. Do you think getting a second lease on life has sort of loosened Desmond up?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. I think it's possible. I think it's just like the whole experience that he's had with flashes before your eyes, which has already happened for him at this point, too, has probably like clarified for him things a little bit more. I do think that like the sobriety piece is not insignificant right now, because you will see in flashes before your eyes what Desmond's like when he gets drunk again and what the disparity is like. So, yeah,
he's a very sad drunk.
He's a sad drunk, but he's like a lively drunk too. There's a lot going on with Desmond drinking. There's a lot going on with Jack, who's just watching Looney Tunes.
I love it. They're like, all right, Jack, you've been upgraded from baseball games to public domain cartoons that you can watch, yes, at your leisure.
Really incredible. Just to put a note in it, Jack being so frustrated that he's been strapped into this room watching TV, this is a clear signal, Mike, that we are nothing like this man.
Yeah.
This had been our fate. If someone was coming in and giving me grilled cheese sandwiches every hour on the hour, making me watch television, I'd probably be pretty happy with these conditions.
To the point where they'd say, like, okay, you can leave, but you have to give surgery to Ben. I'm like, can Ben wait, like, a few more weeks? I really need to finish Legends of Tomorrow. You're really lucky. Left me on a cliffhanger here. Can I take like a quick month to finish things up and then I'll do it? I'll promise I'll do it then. Or maybe after I do it, I'm like, all right, I'm with you guys now. As long as you keep offering TV and fruit salad, I'm with you guys.
Yeah, I'm in. Fruit snacks are the key to my heart. Juliet shows up and Jack is going to vent some frustration. Let's listen to sound number one.
How are you doing today, Jack?
Great.
You seem frustrated.
Am I going to keep watching cartoons, or are you going to tell me why I'm here?
I hope you like blueberry. If not, I can...
Should I talk to Benjamin?
Sorry?
Should I talk to Benjamin? Because I'm starting to think that you're just the person who brings me my food.
You can talk to him all you want, but he won't tell you anything.
You work for him.
No, I don't work for him.
He's in charge.
Well, it doesn't work that way over here, Jack. We make decisions together.
Really? Because when I was holding that broken plate at your neck, he seemed happy to just let you die. I mean, it felt like he made that decision on his own.
You don't know what you're talking about. I don't answer to him.
Juliet, I need you.
Can it wait?
The sub is back. We have a situation. So come with me now.
Josh, Jax got a little bit of gumption back after seemingly being castrated after the events of A Tale of Two Cities. I think he's maybe the cartoons like reset his brain a little bit, and he's trying to use Ben's tactics against Ben here. He's trying to do to Juliet and Ben what Ben did to Locke and him.
Yeah, I'd even going as far as to call him Benjamin when he hates that name. He prefers to be called Coach. I'm sorry, I'm confusing the
yeah, Chucky the Cheese going on Chucky here, watching cartoons and everything.
Chucky the Grilled Cheese. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I was thinking, I was like, why does he call him Benjamin? But I guess Ben does introduce himself as Benjamin Linus, so Jack doesn't necessarily right. know about the nickname yet.
I believe that's right. But yeah, he's, you know, listen, he's got some measure of cabin fever. This is how long at this point? This is probably like, what, 3 days? Of captivity. You know, jokes aside, I think being stuck in a room and getting grilled cheeses and watching Looney Tunes sounds, you know, decently okay. But when you have no idea what's happening to your friends, when you have no idea why you're here, this is all very disorienting and terrible.
Yeah. And I think that Jack is also ready to make a move right now. Like, I think he was playing possum for a little bit. But now, much like Kate, he is someone who's constantly thinking, okay, what's my next move? How do I get out of here? And it looks like he was building some rapport with Juliet, and he noticed that thing that he did with the broken plate. And so he said, all right, let me try this tactic. I mean, he doesn't necessarily know that there is clearly more strain in that relationship than even he realizes. And, you know, Juliet's trying to put up an okay front here with, you know, we make decisions together. But the humor comes from the fact that this is immediately undermined by Ben barging in and saying, Juliet, I need you. Follow me now.
Yeah, follow me now.
I should say, I think this is the first mention of the sub. I'm a little intrigued as to why they didn't take the boat with which they took the other boat, but yeah. I guess they wanted to be super undercover or something.
Yeah, I think they submarined their way in, and then like once they'd secured the sailboat, they brought in the other boat. I don't know. It seems like a lot of boats for one sailboat. Just a lot of boat action.
No wonder Colleen probably died by the time she got onto that stretcher. They kept taking her on boat trips to get to Hydra Island.
Did the tugboat tug the submarine? Like, I'm just so confused about how all the boats were working together. What if when Ben says the sub is back, he meant that, like, the sandwich guy has returned from an off-island trip? We got to eat some sandwiches before the sandwich guy goes again.
Or it's like, I don't know, Jason's birthday, and in the break room, they got, like, a 12-foot sub that Ben has strictly instructed that they all have to consume. And, like, I don't want to throw out this sub. That feels like a waste, so you're all going to eat at least 2 feet of it.
Oh, but it's those, like, weird Subway tomatoes. They're no good.
Yeah, and I don't like banana peppers, Ben. Tough.
And the bread, it just smells so distinct. I don't know why. It's just, it has this smell, and I can't stand it. Anyways, the Subway is being installed near the runway. I don't think we ever get to see that on the show,
unfortunately. Yeah, no. Well, I think had Kate and Sawyer not escaped, they would have gotten to work on the Subway after the runway.
Yeah, slinging half sandwiches left and right. Pickett and the gang show up to take James and Kate to work. And Sawyer's like trying to goad Pickett into another fight. He's calling him Chinatown. He says, you're very stuffy right now. And Pickett says, give me an excuse. And so it's like, I just did. But then something comes in over the radio. Someone comes in for Pickett, and Danny, as he is known, has some very bad news, and he runs away. And this is when we get the clip we heard at the top of the podcast of Sawyer being like, we happened, scored one for our team.
Yeah. So Sawyer, again, clearly, we found this out a couple episodes ago, that this is a con man. He's always thinking 3 steps ahead. And so he is using this as like a score for him, an opportunity to at least incapacitate his enemies immediately. The interesting thing for me is, you know, they see Ben and Juliet, the hubbub, they sort of run out. Ben mutters to Juliet that this is your bed. And I'm a little confused as to what that means. Does it mean literally like, okay, this is the bed in which you'll be operating on Colleen? Or is he somehow blaming her for sending Colleen out on that expedition to get the boat back?
Ben's just at this point right now, right, where he's just like blaming Juliet for absolutely everything. Like now that he's been hard rejected by Juliet, he's just like taking out all of these microaggressions on her.
Yeah, like, oh, who left the milk out when it's completely empty? Gotta be Juliet. Yeah. You know.
Got any milk? No, we don't, because Juliet drank it all.
Exactly. Why are my shirts pink? God damn it, Juliet.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
To be fair, she is literally...
I didn't have much of a theory on that, but I think it's probably somewhere in that realm, I would guess.
I mean, to be fair, Juliet is literally everywhere on Hydra at every point in time, so maybe she is truly responsible for these things.
Yeah, yeah. Alright, so bad stuff happening there, but Sawyer's happy. He sees an inn for an escape
attempt.
By
inn, you mean like a Mr. Wizard experiment gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, he's got an idea. So Sawyer's going to be triggering the polar bear cage as the reward, and his plan is he's going to make a little pool of water. He is going to grab whoever comes next. He's going to zap himself and the person and just shock absorb the shock because he can handle it.
Yeah.
He's a badass.
Well, I think it also might be, maybe I'm looking too much into this line, but he does say, you know, I'll be able to survive the shock because I felt it before. I feel like this might also talk about Sawyer as a person, considering that he specializes in taking people by surprise, that he feels like he's never truly shocked. And that's what makes the ending of this episode work so well, is because when someone actually does get one over him, it's a rarity, because this is the guy who, again, is used to shocking people, not the other way around.
Yeah, so he's got this plan, and Kate's like, ooh, good plan. Like the plan. I'm into this plan.
Yeah, though, I mean, Kate's like, we gotta go for Jack. And Sawyer just says, he might not even be alive.
Jack, schmack, come on.
We gotta take care of ourselves.
And Kate's like, didn't you just tell him that he's your only friend?
He didn't hear that part. Different island, different rules.
You weren't there, yeah. I don't know that it's a different island yet, but, yeah. This is where he says it's every man for himself. And it took me a couple of watch-throughs on Lost to pick up on how every man for himself, which is the name of this episode, it's a thing that Sawyer says a bunch of times in this episode, comes directly from the Live Together, Die Alone speech. That, you know, it's Jack saying we can't do every man for himself is not going to work out here. And that's what he says. If we don't live together, we're going to die alone. So it's straight out of that iconic speech from Lost lore. Does not yield necessarily an iconic episode of Lost, but so far, you know, it's good. This is a good episode, Lost.
Yeah, the connective tissue is there as well, right? Because I think Sawyer and Kate are now having this tug of war between individuality and supporting the group. And granted, the group is very small at this point, but, you know, Sawyer, despite going on the expeditions and helping the group out near the end of the season, despite the events of the Long Con, there is still that part of Sawyer that's always going to be that person, James Ford, who's like, no, you got to strike off on your own. Like, he'll tell Munson later in the weird little, like, sports hallway, like they're going out to play the Super Bowl. You know, if you care about someone, all you do is set yourself up for hurt. And in this case, Sawyer's setting himself up for a world of hurt, because he's basically trying to do a sacrificial mission at this point, being like, I will get myself shocked so that we can, you know,
shot? He's going to get shot?
Shocked! I said shocked! So that I could, you know, you can get away. Like, I don't know if he thinks he and Kate would be able to get away. I wonder if his initial plan was more so that, like, he would take the shock and face the punishment of the others, but he would allow Kate to escape. I don't know, a man who takes like an electrical shock would be in as much of a good condition to be able to escape the island as they do at the end of
Idea. He feels like he can handle it.
He's not Barry Allen, he's Sawyer.
We know that he can take some hurt, though, because we see in the flashback, Sawyer's in jail. And as they do in jail, there's a boxing tournament happening. I know this because Oz did a boxing tournament arc during one season. So this is clearly something that happens in prisons across America. James Sawyer Ford in the ring. He wins his fight. This guy says, I should have been following your eyes, not your feet. And so Sawyer's like, yeah, by the way, who's that dude? And it's Javier from Felicity, Ian Gomez, a.k.a. Munson, who's got $10 million hidden. And Bill Duke from Predator is the warden. And I love that Bill Duke is on Lost in this very random role. Sawyer has a great extended cast of people that would have made the Tampa job a really incredible time.
Yeah.
If they'd kind of done like the Marvel Cinematic Universe of Sawyer characters in the Tampa job, you've got the T-1000, right. You've got Mac from Predator. Like, it's a pretty good lineup of people. You got Javier from Felicity.
Yeah, though he might not be particularly happy with Sawyer after this.
No.
this episode, the flashbacks in particular, like a fun group of those guys. What do you think about Sawyer's jail hair? He has the samurai look going on with the half up, half down.
Yeah, he's like Tom Cruise Last Samurai, hanging out with Katsumoto and just like chilling in the Japanese fields. Yeah, he's sort of like got that look to him right now. It's all right. Like, we see this look for Sawyer a few more times over the course of the show, I think.
Yeah, I want to say, I can't remember if his LaFleur look is just all the way pulled back or if he does the samurai look again.
I don't quite remember. But he's gonna be like taking the piss out of Munson. He calls him Costanza. he says, the warden's being nice to you because he just wants that money, money, money. He wants to butter you up and give you a plum job. What's a plum job? Is that anything like Ray Mullen and his peaches?
Well, it makes sense why it's a plum job, because I'm assuming after the warden gets through his supply of apples, plums will be next for him to casually eat only half of and then throw on the floor for Sawyer to pick up.
In the warden's defense, so the warden shows up as Sawyer saying, I hate the warden. I'm giving you free advice because I hate the warden so much. I'm telling you what you need to do with your money. He's gonna use your wife against you. He's gonna do all this stuff. You don't want anything to do with this guy. And the warden shows up eating a red delicious apple, the wax fruit of fruit. And he takes like one bite and throws it on the ground and says to Sawyer, take that trash. And I think he's right. It's who prefers a red delicious apple? Who goes for the red delicious?
I mean, I would also assume that when you're in prison, even if you're part of the staff, you're not exactly picking among the best of the best when it comes to fruit, unless he busts that apple in from outside. In which case,
if you're
just a terrible
contraband, fruit contraband.
Yeah,
in
and
that
if
case.
That's the case, that he's just a terrible decider when it comes to fruit.
I mean, I get it. If you're incarcerated, like, eat it for sure. I mean, you don't have necessarily. Like the,
you need
the
roughage
the
when you face your daily beatings, Munchson.
But if you're the warden, you bring your own fruit. Don't, or at least eat something else. Don't eat the delicious. Then why is it called a delicious apple when it's not? It's anything but. It is the bottom tier fruit. It's the lowest of the lows.
It's overcompensating, right? It's when people say, like, one of their qualities is, oh, I'm funny. It's like, if you need to explain it, then oftentimes you're not actually it.
And so he throws the wax fruit. All of this is a con. Right,
yeah.
Is what we're going to come to find out, that the warden and Sawyer are in cahoots.
Which is why the warden acts straight out of, like, you know, Cool Hand Luke or, like, insert prison movie here, with just being so OTT, staring not even daggers, but, like, battle axes at Sawyer and haphazardly dropping fruit on the floor.
I love Bill Duke. It's so great to have him on Lost for, like, 5 seconds. Such a strange, strange special guest star appearance, but it's great. Back on the island. Here comes the big kahuna, Benjamin Linus, showing up to talk to Sawyer and ask him, how much do you weigh? A very inappropriate question.
Yeah, though I think it was that they're doing they're having a bet in the office. They're doing an office pool as to who's weighing what.
I thought
what.
That they had all the intel on these people. Don't they know? Shouldn't they know how much he weighs? Or is like, has he gained or lost some?
That would be my assumption, right? As much as they might have recently stumbled into a bunch of new food, I can only assume living on an island for a month plus probably changed your weight somewhat, even though Hurley speaks up against that.
Yeah, could be. Could be.
It's interesting comparing that first warden scene directly to this, right? Because it's another type of prison situation where Ben is the warden here. And once again, the warden has power over him. Though this time, you know, much like we experienced in A Tale of Two Cities, Sawyer's going to give Ben a wise-ass line. And rather than giving a retort, Ben just gets straight down to business and shows, like, I'm not even going to listen to the sass that you're giving me.
Sawyer says he's 32. Don't lie. I'm 35. Why are you lying about 3 years?
I don't know. Is there something? Is there a rubric for ages, much like my rubric for Lost, that like a 30
maybe.
To 32 means something than a 33 to 36?
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm the same age as Sawyer. How about that?
Oh, happy Sawyer year.
Yeah, this is a great year. Relative terms. Sawyer is going to try and pull his prank on Ben. It doesn't work. And yeah, Sawyer's very upset about this. A fun little
moment from The Leftovers-esque with Sawyer trying to turn the two keys in a manner of speaking with grabbing Ben's hand and kicking the button.
That is a mental picture for sure.
I think some people would like that mental picture. But I mean, I love this scene, Josh, because not only does Ben step through the science BS and turn off the button, but this is the first appearance of, I'd say, Ben's main weapon, the telescopic baton.
Do we want to dole out MVP points to the baton?
No, not yet, because I feel like the baton's going to have a better day. I want to say in the shape of things to come, I think, is really the baton's coming out party.
Coming out. Yeah, I think that we're not going to give the baton any MVP points ever. I think we have to keep those inanimate objects relegated to just to drugs as of this recording. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes. But yeah, here comes the beating stick that Ben is going to use a few times throughout the series, and it is making its first debut here against Sawyer. And it's effective enough that he's able to knock Sawyer unconscious. When Sawyer wakes up, he's in a table, strapped to a table in a room. He's overhearing Ben and Tom, and thank God somebody's talking about the purple sky.
Yeah, exactly. What the 815ers couldn't do, the others who have lived on this island for much longer are actually saying, well, that's actually kind of creepy. And we get the first message here about the communications being down. So again, talking about the front that Ben put up in the end of the Glass Ballerina, being like, we know everything about the outside world. Not as much as they previously did, because at this moment, they are not able to have communications with said outside world.
Yeah, so they're not able to figure that out. Comms are down.
Certain comms are down, apparently, because Jack, and this is, I guess, goes, do we have to revise what we said about A Tale of Two Cities, Josh, the PA system, considering that Jack was able to overhear Sawyer here?
We don't. So what's happened here, because we said that the smoke monster was in the PA system, right?
Yeah.
So the smoke monster, much as the smoke monster is able to grab a hold of your larynx and your vocal cords, and constrict them and make it impossible for you to speak, which is what happened to John Locke in Further Instructions. The smoke monster is in Jack's ear right now, enhancing his ability to hear.
The smoke monster hearing aid!
In a very targeted, direct sound microphone sort of situation. So, yeah, so that's what's happening. That's why Jack is able to hear Sawyer through the comm link. It's not through the comm link. He's got a little bit of monster in his ear.
Either that or Smokey was sort of lying in the peripherals, overheard Sawyer, and then like a parrot sort of threw his voice into the PA system just to, as we talked about in Tale of Two Cities, screw with Jack even more.
I hope people are okay with the fact that I'm not really taking this stuff too seriously today. I'm just like, that's where I'm at right now. So it's just every man for himself. I hope that we're going to get
every joke for itself on this podcast.
So they're going to shove a big needle into Sawyer. So this is all hijinks. This is chicanery. None of this is for anything. It's just to con Sawyer.
Yeah. Do you think
and part of conning Sawyer is like the con air move of shoving the needle into his sternum?
Well, I was going to say, let's con air more Pulp Fiction, right? Mm-hmm. Except in that case, is to wake somebody up, not put them to sleep. Because I guess...
Sorry, I was thinking of The Rock, too, even though there is an Alcatraz reference later on in this episode.
I was wondering, did they expect Sawyer to get knocked out, or were they really going to, like... You know, we have to wonder, what did they put in his chest? Did they just slice him and then sew him up again to make it believe that it was a pacemaker? Maybe it was the same sedative that they gave the rabbit is what they injected into Sawyer's body, in which case going through the sternum is not a great idea. And I also love this, like, day one rookie other who's like, oh, I gotta go through the sternum. Whoops.
It's Jason, right? This is Jason?
One of them's Jason. I can't remember, but he definitely...
Not McCormick, no relation.
But he definitely seems like he... I don't know if he meant to slip that first time. Again, you have to wonder in this episode, how much are each of these lines a con? How much is this other's ineptitude at the first time as to where to put the needle? Was that to spook Sawyer, or was this purely from the fact that this guy was kind of struggling under the spotlights of it all?
This whole thing is ridiculous. We'll get into it in greater detail in a little bit. First, let's go back to the beach, and let's talk about that Desmond and Paolo scene that we mentioned before, and let's actually listen in as Desmond is going to waltz up to Paolo, just be like, hey, you're just a random jabroni, right? I could just take your 5-iron, and Paolo's like, yeah, all right, go for it.
Don't mind me, brother. I'm just gonna take one of your clubs. Harley said it'd be all right.
Harley, huh? Must mean you're off to save the day.
So, I can take one of these.
Take the five iron. I never use it. That way when you die in the jungle, doing whatever you're doing, I don't have to go looking for it.
Thanks, man. You might want to square your shoulders a bit more.
You play golf.
I'm Scottish. Cheers.
Josh, I think we needed... That's had Paolo so not died, we were missing out on an episode a la Happy Gilmore of Desmond teaching Paolo how to become a better golfer.
Yeah.
It's old in the hips.
Yeah. Tap it in. Just tap it in. Yeah.
Oh, if only. So I want to talk about something for a second, because we had a great conversation with a great listener of the podcast, Phoebe Nugent, over this past week about the introductory scene to Nikki and Paolo. And again, yes. I'm very excited to have a deep dive into these characters, but this scene is a great reason as to why these characters didn't work from the jump, which is, Josh, that Nikki and Paolo at this point are such negative Nancys.
Yes.
And it makes sense from, like, the timeline perspective, right? We're going to find out in expose, like, they were along with 815. They've been suffering along with the rest of them this entire time. Certainly from a character perspective, they are tired. They're looking for diamonds. Like, they are done with it. But the way they get dropped into the show is, you know, Nikki yelling at Hurley, why didn't you tell us beforehand that, you know, that Jack was gone? Or them having...
Well, I don't know. I was just kidnapped. I just got back from being kidnapped.
Yeah, or like them having sex in Jack's tent while he's gone. Like, the introduction to these characters from a psychological standpoint makes sense. But the first thing we see of these people, including in this scene, was just them just like bitching and moaning, being like, oh, well, you're gonna die anyway. Or, oh, right. Hurley told you. Well, Hurley's one of the big guys in the camp, so I guess that's okay. Like, I understand the meta aspect of it that the show is trying to do in its third season. But that being said, nobody's going to really want to associate themselves with these characters. That's why Shannon was such a disliked character from the very beginning, right? In the pilot.
Totally.
She goes on the expedition, all she does is sit around and be like, I'm not going to eat. We're going to eat on the rescue boat. Shut up, Boone.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I think, remember back in the day when we used to read like the abandoned storylines for season one from the series Bible, Nikki and Paolo are like, the personification of some of those abandoned bad ideas.
Yes!
That, like, actually made it onto the show. Like, this is, like, they are, like, the human representations, the ambassadors of a very bad storyline. And they just happen to make it through. And I know I might catch heat for this, but they're part of the reason why I love season three so much, because this is just such a losty season of Lost. It is a warts and all season of Lost. Like, this is a season of Lost where it is starting to buckle under the weight of can the premise of the show sustain itself for this long without really barreling forward, without that sense of forward momentum? Can this show continue on at, you know, even when it gets down to like 16 episodes a season or 18 episodes a season, it still feels like it might be too much sometimes. And like, you get into season three and there's no end point in sight at this point. And they need to keep things fresh, and they think like, all right, well, people have been talking about background players for so long, should we bring them in? And they bring them in, and it's a fail. I think that's kind of great. I think it's as if, like, you care about, like the autopsies on TV of, like, if you can accept as a blanket that you love Lost, that you love the show, that the highs of the show are the things that stick out to you much more than the lows, then I think that, at least for me, I'm able to develop a fondness for the lows. And Nikki and Paolo are such lows.
They're Paolos.
You know, and I am able to see that. So I think it's fascinating in terms of like the creation of the show. The fact that they are here at all, it should not have happened, and yet and yet. But I do think that, again, it is Desmond, you know, being like, I'm Scottish. Of course I play golf. Like, of course I could tell you how to do that. It's just a fun character note for Desmond. Just like, it's a really good look for this character.
This is, I think, an underratingly funny episode, whether incidentally or not. And this is a little character moment as well, where the scene that I played was the entire scene, and it lasted all of 40 seconds. I think the Desmond stuff ends up totaling, what, like 3 or 4 scenes as well in terms of the flash, comparing it to
something
the flashbacks.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's clear that things are much more heavily weighted towards the Hydra section of things, which, again, makes sense, though it lies a little weird butted up against last week, which had no Hydra stuff whatsoever in terms of the balance. They sort of want to overcompensate in this episode.
All right, well, let's talk about weird. We go back to Hydra. Sora wakes up again, and here comes Benjamin Linus. He has a bunny in a cage, and it gets very, very, very strange very quickly.
What the hell?
Shh.
Hey. Hey, come on. Hey, move. Let's move. Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on.
What are you doing?
Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Let's move it, let's move it, let's move it.
Hippity hop, hippity hop, hippity hop.
Let's move it, let's move it.
What's your problem?
Come on, come on, come on, come on.
I don't know if it's supposed to be funny, but Michael Emerson is just so good sounding like that, like trying to do a psych out from basketball. Like, hey, come on, come on, come on, come on, hippity hoppity, come on, come on, hey, come on, come on, hey, here we go, hey, better swing.
It is so weird. It is the weirdest thing. This is, in 2 full seasons plus 4 episodes of Lost, and there's been a polar bear and a smoke monster. This is like the strangest, weirdest thing. Is Ben Linus showing up with a bunny with an 8 tattooed on it, shaking the bunny and going, hey, come on, come on, come on, come on, let's go, let's go, let's go, hey, come on, hey.
So he's going to go into, like, you know, I put this bunny, this pacemaker in the rabbit. It happens whenever it's, what, excited or anxious or fearful. I'm not sure what feeling Ben was trying to inspire in this rabbit.
So weird. One of the weirdest scenes in all of Lost. I've never forgotten how weird this
scene
is.
Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, hippity hop, hippity hop.
It is so bizarre.
Well, Easter must be a terrifying time in barracks for poor Alex.
There's a few things about the barracks that I'd be very nervous about as it pertains to Ben's chateau based on these effusive noises he's making here. So Sawyer's like, did you just kill a bunny? And so he didn't, or at least we don't know. It seems like maybe he didn't, as we'll come to find out later. What he did do is he demonstrated to Sawyer what is going to happen to him. Do you know what a pacemaker is? He tells Sawyer, it's just going to give your heart a little kickstart if it needs a kickstart. Hopefully you've got like a low enough threshold that you're going to, your Kickstarter is going to succeed. And he says, your heart's going to blow up. If you get a big active heart rate, your heart's going to go, and here's a watch, and it's going to tell you whether or not your heart's going to explode. It's like, Sawyer falls for this? Sawyer is a freaking moron. Sawyer is so stupid. It's like, here's a bomb on your heart. Yeah. You don't run away anymore, because we're going to blow up your heart. And Sawyer's like, oh, man, they got me.
Well, you know, Speed, you're the bus now, Sawyer.
You're the bus. Your heart is the bus. And you're Keanu Reeves, and you got to keep that bus under a certain MPH.
See, I quibble less with Sawyer really taking this at face value, because again, like, Ben, I guess he took the bunny thing at face value, that, like, this guy's clearly creepy, and, like, it wouldn't put it past them to do that. I think the whole thing about, like, you can't tell Kate, or we'll put one in her, too, is, like, I think him falling for that is a little daft. And maybe he's clouded by his feelings for Kate at the moment, but that would seem a little extreme, even from the other's, like, immense psychological torture perspective.
Yeah. It's just so strange, Mike. We're going to blow up your heart. So stop being a dick, Sawyer. We're gonna explode your heart. I guess, like, Sawyer has seen some weird stuff. Apparently, pushing a button was preventing the end of the world. He was doing that for a little while. He doesn't know what the others are capable of.
I mean, maybe he did firsthand experience, like, getting shot by them and getting their boat blown up to kidnap Walt. So I think he thinks of them as very depraved, evil people, even though Ben, once again channeling the season 2 finale, will insist to Sawyer, we're not killers, James, but also there's a bomb on your heart.
I think the fact that they get him hook, line, and sinker on this one, though, like, why Ben flips the script and tells him, no, we didn't put a bomb in your heart, James. I don't know why you'd, I would tell Sawyer for the rest of the series, like, yeah, you got a bomb in your heart, dude. So you just better be careful, because if you do anything stupid, we're going to blow up your heart.
Well, we'll get to a moment later on that, like, might have, should have given up the goose. But here in the moment, I can understand, because again, Ben's presentation, his TED Talk, if you will, is spooky enough and weird enough to get Sawyer being like, okay, this crazy son of a bitch might actually put a pacemaker in. And I guess thinking about it more so when I was asking about, like, was the incision just for show, that there are no surgeons active on the island at this point. So, yeah, I guess they did just literally cut him open and then stitch him up once he passed out. They just
stabbed him with a thing, and that's it.
They did diddly squat.
Yeah, it's just a little slice and a stitch. That's what we call going out for pizza in a comedy show in New York. So Sawyer is taken back to the cages. He's got a bucket to clean himself with. Kate has one as well, plus a new change of clothes. Mr. Friendly says, listen, Kate, if any of that doesn't fit, just let me know. I'll come get you new stuff.
See, he's such a good friend to her. That's why they call him Mr. Friendly.
Good, nice guy. Nice guy, Tom. So Kate's like, what happened? Sawyer's like, nothing. Sawyer, nothing. James, did they put a bomb in your heart? Oh,
make
you got
something
it.
Got it up. You are a con man.
Got it in one. She gets changed. He watches. His heart rate accelerates and pushes him into the danger zone. Cue the music.
Yeah, this really is something out of like American Pie, right? Of like, oh, I said I wouldn't do it, but now I'm watching her change. And then he flash dances himself. He pours water all over himself to try to cool himself down. And I will say, obviously not nearly as annoying as the transition noises from maternity leave, but I will say the watch beeping that was supposed to be tense, once you know what the episode is, gets a little annoying after a while.
Yeah, an abandoned storyline, I believe, is that the watch goes off and then somewhere on the other island, on the main island, Jin Kwan's ears perk up and he goes, watch! And he swims into the ocean and swims all the way to Hydra Island to beat up whoever has the watch.
No, I believe actually in Meet Kevin Johnson, Michael's going to find it watched up and then Jin's going to swim in after him on a tidal wave and just beat the crap out of Michael for finding it.
Exactly. So, the watch is, Sawyer just doesn't strike me as a watch guy either. So him with like a digital watch is sort of weird.
Digital watches instead of like the fancy analog ones like we saw with Mr. Pake.
I guess, you know, if it washed up, he'd be like, yeah, I want the watch. You know, it's something to do.
Well, it definitely would be something he'd whore at, like, hey, if you want to know what the time is, you better give me something
I want.
You better
talk to me. Yeah, for sure. He's the keeper of the clock. Sawyer, to cool down his heart rate, pours a bucket of water on himself, and that immediately slows his heart rate. So this is a good tactic to know that in the future when I'm having a real anxious episode and my heart rate is going, I should just dump a full bucket of water on my head and immediately I will stop being so anxious.
Well, I think it's less about anxiety and more like the Austin Powers, Margaret Thatcher naked on a cold day type of thing of trying to stymie those urges. You know, Sawyer had his moment of being cornered out with Anna Lucia a short time ago, but he's been holding a torch for Kate for quite some time, and I think getting the first opportunity to see some of that backside, and he'll see much more than that backside in a little bit, but at this point, like you said, I guess he can't help it. He, despite turning away, he decides to sneak a peek. I guess in that moment, he's like, screw it, if I go out, at least I go out watching something I like.
At least I go out with porn. Yeah. Sawyer, flashback mode. Speaking of like Sawyer's Avengers, you know, Kim Dickens is certainly no slouch either. And here comes Cassidy returning to the mix, and she's got some very big news for James.
Hello, Sawyer.
It's James Ford. And I know you know that because you got it right when you pressed charges.
You're mad at me?
Well, look where I am.
What did you want me to do? You conned me.
Something you want.
Yeah. Yeah. There is.
Come on, I got license plates to make.
Thank you.
process.
This is your daughter.
What do you want?
Well, first I wanted you to know.
Then what? Think I'm gonna take one look at this picture and turn into Father Knows Best?
We're living in this little place in Albuquerque. It's near the university.
Are you telling me this?
I just thought you could write her a letter. Her name's Clementine.
What the hell am I gonna write? Dear Goo Goo Gaga, she's a baby. She ain't mine.
Sawyer, she...
I ain't got no daughter.
Josh, sound the trumpets. We have come to Mike Bloom's favorite line in all of Lost.
Dear Goo Goo Gaga, she's a baby.
Yes, yes. Just to review, this is my favorite line in all of Lost.
What the hell am I gonna write? Dear Goo Goo Gaga, she's a baby. She ain't mine.
It's a very good line.
Oh, it makes me laugh every goddamn time since the very first time
every
I saw
Goo Goo
this.
Gaga damn time.
It works on so many levels, Josh. This is a 7-layer dip of a line, because it has so many different implications behind it. Like, is he assuming that the baby's name is Goo Goo Gaga, and that's why he's writing it in the foreword, Dear Goo Goo Gaga? Is that he believes that you can babies can only read baby E's, which apparently is Goo Goo Gaga? I love him following up with just the affirmation, she's a baby.
She's a baby.
It's so freaking good!
Well, you know what I love about it too is I think it's a great distillation of James Sawyer Ford, who is this character who can at once be really, really, really funny, just has like incredible dialogue, but also could be very intense and could be very, very haunted. And so much is happening here, not just in the line of like, dear Goo Goo Gaga, she's a baby, but the fact that that's a very funny line, the fact that it is filled with such like kind of, it's not malice. I mean, like, it sort of is like he's being really mean to Cassidy, but you know that the reason why is because he's like, oh shit, I've created life. The whole reason that I'm so miserable and rotten is because of what happened to me and my parents and what that death created for me. And now am I like, I'm the absentee father in jail. And like, this is gonna be a thing for Clementine. Like, I think a lot is happening psychologically with this character too. So compounding that with a really funny line, I think that this, I'm not disappointed at all. I think that this is one of the underrated moments of the episode for sure. I think best line in all of Lost, not for me, but I totally get it. Like, it's one of those very personal, subjective things. It's a great line. It's very, very funny, and it means a lot.
And it's also like, it's quintessential me, right? Like, it's dumb. It's sarcastic. It's goofy. There are certainly better lines in Lost, but this is my favorite. It's also one of my favorites because there's a little bit of hipster in me that, like, you know, I have definitely divulged into many Lost message boards and conversations. And when people talk about, like, very funny moments in Lost, nobody points this line out. And this is one that ever since the end of 2005 has, like, continually stuck with me since this episode. And so it has, like, only grown more and more renown in my head of, like, nobody knows about the gold mine that is Dear Goo Goo Gaga. And I was so excited to finally unveil this. So your mileage may vary. I love the line. But to get into the more serious aspects of it, I do agree that if there's anything to get out of this flashback whatsoever, it's Sawyer's reaction to Clementine. Because there is so much baked in there. It's this idea of, like, generational trauma, you know, or this idea of that he is now responsible for someone else, right? He is someone who is going to espouse to Munson later on, don't care about people, because the more people you have involved in your life, the more hearts you have to break, essentially. And this is somebody who, unlike Cassidy, he can't straight up and leave. This is blood. This is someone, he hasn't had blood in his life since a very young age, and that has determined the course of his life. So I can imagine how big of a reaction it is and how he would want to be in denial of that and refuse to allow that into his life. Because not only is it a big deal in terms of a seismic change in his life, but that brings in a whole new weight of responsibility that is going to cause him to question his actions. And at this point, Sawyer is miring in his actions anyway. He's self-flagellating the fact that, yeah, I'm a con man, but I hate myself for doing it. And so I think he would feel ashamed that, okay, you know, I'm a bad person, and he would hate to have his own daughter know how bad of a person he is, which I think also contributes to his decision ultimately to, you know, open up the anonymous account and try to keep Clementine from knowing who he is at all. It's less so,
but still trying, like, in his way to be like a good parent.
Yeah, and I think, and I, so then from that capacity, it's not a selfish decision. It's a selfless decision. It's saying, I corrupt anyone who comes into my life. I don't want this to happen to this person.
Right. Right. Exactly. Sawyer's great. What a great character.
Yeah. And also we get a mention of Albuquerque here, which will obviously come back. And I thought it was in Left Behind, but I guess it's in season 5 when Kate visits Cassidy. Though maybe, who knows? Maybe Kate was dropping by and visiting Cassidy during the events of whatever the case may be.
Yeah. They're gonna run into each other this season. Yeah. But it's that future interaction. Then. Yep. Speaking of Kate, she's like, I think I could probably squeeze out of this cage.
Yeah, why are the bars spaced further at the top than the rest of the cage for some reason?
I don't think that they ever thought that the polar bears were going to get that high, and certainly the polar bears wouldn't be able to squeeze out of the cage.
The bears were able to solve complex food puzzles. You don't think they'd be able to climb to the top of the cage?
I'm not saying that, Mike, but I am saying that they're not going to squeeze out of those bars. Yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
They're gigantic. They're polar bears.
But I just don't know the designers are being like, okay, I know the size of the bars on the sides, but let's maybe we can make them a little wider on top. Why the hell not?
It's more ventilation. I don't know. It's all open air. That doesn't really make any sense.
It's all air.
I don't really know. Jack, once again, hearing things on the monitor. He's still listening in. And here comes Juliet in scrubs, covered in blood. This isn't Sawyer's blood. Stop freaking out about Sawyer, she tells him. There's a woman who is dying, and I need your help. Cue the sirens, Mike. The noise that is even worse than the watch. As the sirens are blaring, and Kate and Sawyer see a blindfolded Jack. Mm. And they're screaming for him. Screaming bloody murder.
I can't remember, just because I know Jack is going to flinch here. So obviously, maybe making it like the blaring work, but maybe not making it one continuous tone. Like, I don't know, a dial tone wouldn't have helped them. I forget, does this hit Jack at all? That he hears them somewhere.
It seems like he flinches, but like he doesn't have a major...
Right, I can't remember in a future episode if he's like, I know you have them somewhere, I heard their voices.
No, he runs into Kate, right? Like he sees on the monitor Kate and Sawyer, but he also gets a one-on-one with Kate and I do. So that's coming up. That's how he's going to know that they're around.
Yeah, but it looks like Juliet maybe in going along with Jack's point here, getting it rent-free in her head, has gone over Ben's head here. She has made an executive decision. Colleen's life is on the line. And so she says, screw it, throw that potato sack on Jack's head and let's get him into scrub in, because he's got to save this woman's life.
Yeah, and so he goes in. Ben's pissed that Jack has been brought in. Jack is going to catch a glimpse of something. He sees Ben's spine. He's like, oh, going to back pocket that. I see something
and
over
there.
And she's
like, don't be Snoopy.
Yeah, relevant to my interests. They are unable to save Colleen.
Yeah,
the crash cart does not work because nothing like this has happened before, apparently. Ethan rolling in his grave.
Yeah, I would also say, I don't know, maybe also dock points from Ethan because, I don't know, unless the defibrillator broke during the days he was away. But, like, come on. You would not think there's any sort of reason to not have to have a crash cart in any emergency situation. Like, for all you know, someone could collapse while digging ditches and you have to resuscitate their heart. There's only so many needles you can stick in their chest. But I'll give kudos to Jack here. He snaps right into professional doctor mode. He could very easily be snitty and be like, I'm not going to do it. Or, you know, he could be constantly questioning. But for what it's worth, he's a good doctor. He's going to keep his head down, snap right into surgeon mode, and try the best he can to save Colleen's life. But you know what? For poor Jack, CPR does not work on everybody, evidently.
No, do no harm is the code. So Jack is going to do his job, but it doesn't work. It is the end for Colleen. Hardly knew you, Colleen. Pickett is very upset about this, and it leads Danny to go outside and take out his aggression on James Sawyer Ford. Shall we put some Sawyer beatdown music into our ears?
Hey, take it easy! This guy.
What?
I said, do you love him?
Stop!
Do you love him? Do you love him?
Leave him alone!
pretty significant beatdown.
Yeah, well, I was going to say,
Sawyer getting hit like 100 times in the head.
I know we're obviously, we have the Ben beatdown. I don't think we're going to do the Sawyer beatdown. Is this better or worse for you than Confidence Man with the torture and everything?
This is like getting hit in the head over and over and over and over and over again is probably going to do more long-term damage and is more of a threat to your life imminently. That being said, bamboo shoots under your fingernails like makes my skin crawl in a way that this does not.
Right. I think this was more dangerous, but the torture was more painful. Purposely so, right? Because they wanted to slowly inject pain into him to get what he wants. Pickett is just straight up...
It's so unusual, yeah. Right? I mean, not that fists are supposed to go on your face, but bamboo shoots are certainly not supposed to go underneath your fingernails.
Yeah, and I mean, Pickett also straight up farcuses Sawyer here. And Sawyer just gets completely wrecked, partially because he can't do anything, because he's still under the construct that... If he, I guess, gets his heart rate going by really getting the adrenaline pumping and fighting Pickett, then that's going to cause things to get blown up. Or maybe he feels like he'd face a worser punishment if he does indeed let Pickett fight back. I will also say Michael Bowen does an awesome job in this scene where he just like, and you see it in the Lost on Location where they go behind the scenes for this particular scene. Like, he is going so aggro and intense and scary in this scene. Ben was just weird scary with the hippity-hop, hippity-hop. Michael Bowen is legitimately scary in this scene, where he is just beating the crap out of Sawyer and seeing complete red due to the death of
his Uncle wife. Uncle Jack, man. You can't trust Uncle Jack. Scary guy. Want to stop down to talk about Yes, I Love Him. Is this true? Mm. Is this Kate just saying something to save him here? Where are you at with all of this? We know that, of course, Jate is Fate,
but
the long haul.
I mean, I'm a Skate fan, but I will say, I don't know, I did not think this was a great Skate episode. I'm personally in the camp that I think Kate lied. Because I think, you know, look how much it took to get Kate to say it. And this is a woman who's also extremely used to lying. She's not someone who wears her heart on her sleeve. So she could very easily be like, yes, I love him. Now stop beating him up. Or, hey, I'd love for you to stop beating this man to death. Does she have feelings for Sawyer? I'm sure of it. But love is such a weighty word. You know, Kate and Jack are going to tell each other that they love each other in the final episode of the series. Like, I do not think love builds over a month plus with these two characters in particular. Maybe someone like Saeed, who is a bleeding heart romantic. But I do not think that Kate Austin would fall in love with somebody, be it Jack or Sawyer, in this limited amount of time.
Do we think of the entire time that Jack and Kate were in a relationship with each other off the island that they never said I love you before?
I don't know. They were in weird places. Right, yeah. Like I can't imagine.
I can see it. I mean, I'm not saying it like that's ridiculous. It's a lot, but I could buy.
I know it's 3 years, so I can understand why it'd be like, well, that's crazy. But also, they are not very amicable. When we flash to them and through the looking glass,
also they went through intense trauma.
Yeah,
they are very damaged people. So who knows?
Yeah, and
who
I think again, Kate is somebody sort of like Sawyer in that perspective, who I think is not willing to necessarily open herself up to people. So I can imagine the fear in telling someone that I love you is a little scary, which is why, again, that moment in the end is such a fun moment for the character, because it's her finally opening herself up to Jack truly and showing her full self, which also makes me also want to support the idea that she's lying here, because it would feel like that gets sort of invalidated by the fact that she did it three seasons beforehand with Sawyer to prevent him from getting properly farcused to death.
In the past, back in prison... what's there to say? Munson wants Sawyer's help. My wife, she's investigating me. She's leaving me. It's like you said, move the money. So I was like, sweet.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
So in your first watch of this, do you remember, like, did you feel like something was up? Or was this another one of the things, sort of like the long con, where you're like, oh, yeah, he's actually going straight the entire time until it turns out to be an entire thing?
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you can't fool me again. You know, so I figured, like, this time Sawyer's, you're not slipping past me, guy. I don't think I probably thought much of it, to be honest. I think I was pretty disengaged with the flashback, would be my guess.
And that's the thing as well, is that I don't want to be repetitive about how repetitive the past two flashbacks have been, but this is another one where outside of the Clementine stuff, there's really nothing else to glean from this character, right? The even the Cassidy relationship, which I'll say the long con, I think, has a bit of an underrated flashback in showing Sawyer sort of tugging with his heart and his head, the latter of which is more centered on conning somebody. We don't really get that here. We get this rando guy showing up. Sawyer tries to get in good with him by making enemy out of the warden. And no, it turns out that the warden was working with him the entire time. And even though he's a bit of a white hat here instead of a black hat, he still, quote, lied and cheated his way out of prison.
So back in a different prison, Sawyer and Kate on the island, on Hydra Island, Sawyer has been, you know, protecting the plate. He's been told, don't tell Kate. Kate is, clearly she's not an idiot. She knows that something's up and she wants to know why Pickett just decided to beat the shit out of you. Why are you acting so weird? And it causes her to make a move. She's going to climb out of the cage through the holes in the top that the polar bears wouldn't stand a chance of coming through. And she's going to have a little bit of an exchange with our guy.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
What does it look like?
Hang on a second, Freckles. I told you, the time ain't right.
You're the one that said we had to go.
Well, that was before this.
Before what? I don't know what they did to you, but I know you're scared enough to lie about it. And that scares me more than anything that they have done to us before.
Wait. Wait. What are you doing?
Get you out of here.
Don't.
I'm not leaving you, Sawyer. I can get it open.
You're already up. Gotta go. You gotta leave me.
What did they do to you?
You don't.
What is that thing?
Run. She's going. Every man for himself.
Why didn't you fight back? Tell me the truth for once in your life.
If you really love me, go.
I only said that so we'd start hitting you.
Run. Hurry! What the hell are you doing? Kate!
Damn it, Freckles, don't. Every man for himself.
Live together, die alone.
Yeah, that sounds like somebody who's more Team Jack than Team Sawyer.
Yeah, considering that she said that back to him. Evangeline Lilly, I feel like, is actually a very underrated part of this episode. I feel like in those two clips that we played in particular, she does a really great job. Though I will say, Kate saying, you know, that I know you're scared enough to lie about it, and that scares me more than anything they've done to us before. Sawyer lies a ton. Kate, that's why you literally say to him, tell me the truth for once in your life. Does she feel like for some reason he wouldn't lie to her at all, despite the fact that he has lied to her profusely in the past?
I think about something like this, where he's like clued her into all of his plans, and the fact that he's come back from wherever they took him and is not talking about why he's no longer interested in pursuing escape. That is what's freaking her out. And I think like, whatever they did, because you're not a person who scares easily. The fact that they succeeded and the fact that you won't tell me what happened, that scares the shit out of me. So I think it's less about the lie and more about like what your lie is representing. Mm. That like maybe they put a bomb on your heart.
So that being said, if Sawyer did indeed want Kate to go, should he have come up with a lie instead of just obfuscating the truth and not saying anything?
She said, listen, Kate, they put a bomb on my heart.
No, like, to bend the truth, it'll be like, they put a bomb on my butt. My butt has a bomb on it.
I don't know if the butt bomb is more believable than the heart bomb. Maybe. But you think he should have probably said, they put a bomb in me. They put a bomb in me and they're going to blow me up. They're going to blow up my heart if you don't leave. Or if I do leave. And Kate would probably at that point like start laughing and be like, dude, they definitely didn't put a bomb in your heart.
Yeah, exactly. But it, you know, it's an interesting skate moment here where Sawyer keeps like rebuffing her, saying every man for himself, every man for himself, which is interesting that he is now twisting the line that he gave Kate as to why they should leave Jack to tell Kate why she should leave him. She feels like he is just pushing her away emotionally. And so she tries to hit him back by being like, well, I didn't actually mean it when I told him I loved you. So again, it's a really interesting, tempestuous moment between the two. But Kate, her stubbornness works for the group at this perspective. She, as much of an independent person as she is, and why she and Sawyer find that in common, she is so devoted to the cause at this point that she hops right back into that cage and says, look, I may have had a chance to escape, but I'm going nowhere without you and maybe
yeah,
Jack.
Yeah, LTDA. LTDA. So all of this is being watched from a secret underground bunker.
Yeah, which is, again, why Kate didn't escape, because she would have been caught dead to rights. Unlike what happened at the end of I Do, they have not had an opportunity to subdue people. Instead, it would just been Kate running into the middle of the jungle. Maybe that's another reason why. I don't know if Sawyer described to Kate what happened with Carl. Not Carl from Love, actually. The actual Carl on Lost. But it seemed like Kate would have tried to do the exact same thing.
Yeah, so Ben's watching all of this, and Tom's like, you know, Danny wants to kill him. And he says, Danny can wait. Who cares about Danny? He's going to be dead soon anyway. He's going to be joining Colleen. Speaking of Colleen, Jack and Juliet are just chilling near Colleen. Jack has not been taken back to his cell yet. Ben wants him to stew there for a little bit longer. And it leads to the following exchange between the doctors, Shepherd and Burke.
I'm sorry. They had to put handcuffs on you. I'm a fertility doctor. I'm not used to death.
What was her name?
Cole. It was short for Colleen. I should have come to get you sooner.
It wouldn't have mattered. There wasn't any more that you could have done. She was dead before you put her on the table.
Are you just saying that to make me feel better?
I don't care about making you feel better.
Take you back now. I'm sorry for bringing you here.
Whose x-rays are those outside? Those are spinal x-rays, and they belong to a man about 40 years old. And whoever he has a very large tumor on his L4 vertebrae. And I just happen to be a spinal surgeon. So, you tell me, Juliet, who am I here to save?
Juliet, after you wash the blood off yourself, you better stop by the burn ward because your ass just got lit up.
Yeah, it got a little hot in there all of a sudden because Jack just brought the heat. There's my guy, Jack Shepherd, who hears a number, you know, pattern once and memorizes it and looks at x-rays for half a second and knows in vivid detail what it is and what that's all about, and completely is like, okay, so this is what this is all about. Got it. Okay. Jack's really great in this episode.
Yeah, this is, again, after being...
Strong Jack episode.
After being so subjugated in the first episode and being so stubborn and then eventually getting, like, beat into docility, he really comes raring out in this episode. And that's why this is an interesting sort of ebb and flow with him and the others, right? Like, it's clear that Ben wants to teach him a lesson, quote-unquote, by handcuffing him to Colleen's dead body to be like, look at what your people did. Like, I think it's less so a punishment of what he could do to save Colleen, because, as they said, there's really nothing you can do, but more so to be like, you lead these people, and look what these people did, and now you will pay for their actions. But you know, Jack being able to, and they didn't leave the x-rays out for Jack to look over, at least not from what I remember. So this is something that he holds a piece of power over them that they did not want him to know.
No, Ben didn't even want him in there at all. Yeah, right?
Exactly.
He's going to tell him later. He's like, ah, oh, man, I didn't want you to see any of that. That's not how I had this whole plan. You ruined the plan.
And I love him. Again, you know, as much as he might feel, as much as Juliet's trying to do the whole good cop routine with him, Jack very curtly tells her, I don't care about making you feel better. Also, interesting little bit of a white lie for Juliet, right? When she says, I'm not used to death. Well, as a fertility doctor, didn't she have like multiple pregnant women die on the island? So either it's her trying to sound more sympathetic or her saying that like it doesn't get any easier.
Oh, I think that, you know, she hasn't seen a lot of like gunshot victims come through her ward. You know, like I don't think that's been on her purview very often.
I mean, I would hope not. I don't know how much the others are exchanging friendly fire.
Yeah, Mr. Friendly Fire. But no, it's a great Jack and Juliet scene. I think stack this against the Sawyer and Kate scene. Which scene do you prefer? The one that we just had with Sawyer and Kate or the one we just had with Jack and Juliet?
I like this one. I think it's a little like, well, it's understandable from a character perspective. I think it's a little frustrating to have Kate go back in the cage. I remember at the time I was pretty miffed that like, okay, we're finally going to see Kate escape. And then she goes back into the cage. It's an understandable character choice, but still a little aggravating because you want to see in some forward momentum in the plot. And this moves the plot forward and also is like a big boon to Jack's character and also plays upon their relationship where she was the jailer for the first episode. And now in the fourth episode, he is sort of holding a bit of power as the prisoner himself, which I think is an inherently more interesting dynamic.
Back on the island, Desmond has finished building this lightning rod, and he goes to hang out with Chef Hurley, who's making a fruit salad. And Hurley looks up from his fruit salad and sees the lightning rod, and he says, is that art?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure a butterfly flew by, right? And Hurley was regarding him with his hand.
Is that arst? No, it's just an experiment. He's got a little science project. So maybe that's arst's legacy. Is he just turned into a bunch of science experiments.
Exactly. He like disseminated himself and inserted arst spores into everybody to be interested in
the
science.
Arst spores. Oh God. They're in the atmosphere. We're breathing them in. The spores. The arst
that's what
spores.
Happens when you explode. You get disseminated into the air and inevitably breathed in by people.
Well, you know what they say, Mike, when it rains, it spores as it starts to pour buckets down on the island and there's this huge bolt of lightning.
Yeah, maybe that's something you can include in your Lost 2 island plot is that eventually, like, the arst cells within everybody ignite and they sort of everyone becomes an arst army of zombies to take over the island from Hurley and Walt and Ben.
I don't know that Animal Crossing gets that dangerous. you have to really like kind of like imply the danger.
Wait for the Last of Us patch to come through and maybe you could do that.
Yeah, that'd be good. But no, the lightning rod catches the lightning. Charlie is safe and Hurley is like, all right, my guy can see the future for sure. 100%.
Yeah, and I think that Desmond shows a little bit of shades of Locke here besides the camera work with him. He obviously knows what's going to happen with the lightning, so he does a bit of like the stop right here and wait for the rain to pour down copiously.
Stop right there! Yeah, so that's what goes on.
R.I.P. Five Iron.
The Five Iron is gone. The next morning, Ben's waking Sawyer up. What do you want to say? Like 4:45? You want to call this 4?
Yeah, I would say like at first light, probably, right? Because otherwise, if the sun rises too much, it gets too hot to make this big hike, especially when Ben's wearing his button-down shirt and long pants.
It's 4:08:15 in the morning.
They have to time it out particularly.
Correct. And so they're going to go for a little walk. We're going to have our fourth and final flashback scene of the episode where Bill Duke's like, you did it. You got him, yes. James. Here's the Treasury Secretary Department agent dude who's like, hey, you got him. We got him. We got that money. So, here's a bonus.
So strange.
You're free,
so
James.
Strange. So, yeah.
This flashback is so whatever.
And you could tell because they literally like yada yada this dude like, thank you for being the prison snitch for me, James. Yes. By the way, you're free now. You're not going to be in jail for any more flashbacks. We're sorry
you're
we did
free.
That, everybody.
Where are you going to go, Sawyer? San Juan Tadeo. Yeah, like, it's just such a strange... Yeah, the whole flashback is just so weird. It is a very sweet moment when he says, put the money in a bank, doesn't matter, make it in Albuquerque, put it in Clementine Phillips' name, and I want it so that she never finds out that it's from me.
It's a sweet moment, sweet. But it's also... It we've seen sweet moments from Sawyer before. So again, it's not... It's par for the course with the Five Iron.
It's not nothing that Sawyer is a dad, right? And that's... We've just discovered this. That this is a show where... where parental issues are so front and center in terms of why people have turned out the way that they've turned out. And for Sawyer to find out that he's a father is not a nothing deal. I think it is dropped upon us in a very casual way.
Yes.
That it doesn't like make a huge, huge impact. But this scene of seeing Sawyer be a good father, if not like, you know, like a highly like emotional or present one. I think he could be a better dad, and I'd like to think that the Sawyer who leaves the island may be prepared to make those steps. Mm. And I would really like to think that for sure. Certainly the Clementine who's on my island on Animal Crossing is a big fan of her father.
Oh, good.
So things worked
out
there.
Did she finally get her letter, Dear Goo Goo Gaga?
Yeah, Dear Goo Goo Gaga. She got the Goo Goo Gaga letter, and she's...
I know in Animal Crossing you're able to, like, suggest catchphrases for animals. Can you please have your Clementine's catchphrase?
I don't think Clementine can, because Clementine, I don't think that you give like your player
Damn
characters
it.
Catchphrases, but all of the different animals on the island, I have started the process of doling out phrases to, but not all of them. Goo Goo Gaga is definitely still capable of being placed on the board.
I think we could definitely put it back into style, but I also wonder...
My favorite person on the island, every time you go up to him, he screams, "What?"
Oh my god, that is amazing.
Just like, it's sometimes there's like no rhyme or reason to it. He's like, "You having a good day today?" He's a super cute blue pig named Hugh, who I like to imagine is Hurley in pig form.
I love it. And because the other Hurley's turning into Titus Welliver.
I think Hurley died, the smoke monster came back, and now he's in Titus Welliver smoke monster mode. And Hurley has been reincarnated as a pig, but he hasn't become awake yet. Mm. He doesn't know that he is Hurley yet.
Exactly. He needs
that's
to
gonna be
he
a, needs, that's going to be a series finale.
He has to touch
twist.
The Apollo bar, and then he'll realize all the Hurley memories.
Exactly.
I wonder if there was, you know, if they did have an outright Sawyer flashback before LaFleur, I wonder if it would have been something along the lines of like him surreptitiously tracking Clementine or something. Because, yeah, it's weird to leave the Sawyer flashbacks off on that note, because it is such a seismic part of his life that it does kind of make me question, you know, we're going to get everything with Frank Duckett, and that'll obviously inform, you know, what he does out of jail. But I wonder how much this was looming on his mind as he proceeded forward with all this.
You do wonder. You have to wonder. You gotta wonder. Sawyer's going to go up and see that he's on this separate island. He's on this secret island. Along the way, he's going to be quoting Mice of Mice and Men. He was reading it in jail. He's disgusted that Ben doesn't know of Mice and Men. What's the problem? You don't read? Puppies get killed. You'd like it. It's your thing.
Yeah, but it turns out that it's fine. The bunny's fine.
The bunny was fine.
We think, unless this was another bunny ape. But as Ben said, like, that's for me to know and you to find out, to both Sawyer and the viewers.
That's for me to find out and for you to know. Ben pulls the bunny out. Yeah, he says, "Hey, come here. Yeah, and so Sawyer punches Ben in the face. There we go. The new contender to the Ben Linus beatdown counter. And I think our tradition continues of in sequential chronological order the ranking. This is the bottom of the list so far. It's just the solitary punch to the face from James Sawyer Ford, I think, has to be anchoring us at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing. It's Ben just takes it and is like, "Okay, I've had worse done to me. Remember that time I got knocked out by a shelf? Let's keep going."
Well, let's keep going, and let's conclude the episode with Ben and Sawyer looking out and seeing that they are not on our island. They are on a different island, and we're going to be quoting some stuff, and it's just what a time to be alive. This is the end of Every Man for Himself.
You ever been to Alcatraz? Take the tour? Right now, you're standing on a small island roughly twice the size of Alcatraz. And that over there, that's your island. The one you've come to know and love. I just wanted you to know, there's nowhere to run. You did all this just to keep me in a damn cage. We did all this because the only way to gain a con man's respect is to con him.
pretty good, Sawyer. We're a lot better. Funny thing is, us telling you about the pacemaker wasn't what kept you in line. It was when I threatened her. You work so hard to make her think you don't care, that you don't need her, but a guy goes nuts if he ain't got nobody. It don't make no difference who the guy is, as long as he's with you. I tell you, a guy gets too lonely and he gets sick.
What the hell are you talking about?
It's from Of Mice and Men. Don't you read? Come on. Let's get you back to your cage.
Mike, my goal is to someday, out of nowhere, recite a passage from Watership Down to you and conclude it by saying, it's from Watership Down, don't you read?
Is it so that like we can all shame you for reading Watership Down? It's just that that moment of Sawyer having power over him has now been distilled across months and months and months.
Yes, that's correct.
This scene, like the actual scene, is so much fun because I love these two characters, and these two characters have also very rarely interacted. Even when Ben was quote unquote Henry Gale, there was very little time. And I do love the power move. Again, this episode is all about power of Ben really showing Sawyer, like, yeah, you think you're hot shit, but our shit is hotter, in a manner of speaking. But I will admit this ending is dulled a little bit by the fact that this is not something that's really followed up on, you know, considering that an I Do, Kate and Sawyer are going to make the escape. And so I feel like, unless I'm not thinking of something, it's not really a thread that they follow up on, that this was Ben's way to sort of subjugate Sawyer and get him in line. We don't get much of good prisoner Sawyer from here on out.
Not really, no, because he's going to be escaping, very soon from now. He's not going to be here for much longer. So we don't really get a ton of I mean, he's going to like tell Kate, like, we're not even on our island. And he's like, going to be like, why are we even bothering to escape? And so they're going to just have happy, you know, he's going to basically be docile, but it's for, you know, literally two episodes maximum at this point. I don't even remember if he's in for the instructions.
I don't think he's in he's not in The Cost of Living. Jack. So yeah, maybe it's like an episode for Sawyer to lick his wounds. Cause that's the thing. I know that people say like, thank God.
This is going to be very hard for him to do that. How does he bend his head down to his chest?
Just need another bucket of water and just look away from Kate. But yeah, I think that, you know, as much as people might malign, like, thank God they get out of these cages at a certain point, it's a really interesting character moment from Sawyer. Because, again, this is a guy who hadn't really been tricked on the island before. The only time before that was Anna Lucia. And this also serves as a great way to really show the might of Benjamin Linus. You know, we saw glimpses of it and what he was able to get Michael to do, or the others were able to get Michael to do at the end of season two. But this episode was really like a tour de force from Ben in terms of big flexes. And so to sort of have that relationship get brought about and then not really get acted up on in the next couple episodes feels like a bit of a missed opportunity. Again, I'm not jockeying for more times on Hydra Island necessarily. I just think this is a strong scene between two characters that would have been made stronger if this really did fundamentally affect Sawyer, you know, in the near future, outside of him being like, why should we even escape?
Let's get into feedback for this episode. Let's begin with the fact that, Mike, a lot of people had guesses about what your favorite line of all of Lost was coming from this episode, coming out of this episode. And here are a few of them. Eric Divestein submitted, I bet the Bears never thought of that one as a contender, as well as, no, you have to go through the sternum like in the movie. Ben Martell wondered if the line was, should I talk to Benjamin? Thomas put out, did you kill that bunny? because it's the only quote of the episode that's on IMDb.
For shame, IMDb. How dare you leave Dear Goo Goo Gaga off of this?
Corey got it. Corey wrote it and said, what am I going to write? Dear Goo Goo Gaga, I'm a baby.
Yes!
So
yes,
congrats
Corey,
to Corey for calling
you.
It out. You got it. You got it. You got it. Joanne, the Pistons fan, pretty annoyed with Ben. Joanne writes in, I want to slap Ben's smug face when he brags about conning Sawyer. Having conned John Locke doesn't make you a con artist, as even Leslie Arst and Vincent the Dog could con Locke. And furthermore, this is not a con. This is literally a hostage situation. They have physically and psychologically tortured Sawyer and threatened Kate's safety. Yeah, I do think that the definition of con is probably in question as it pertains to how Ben has been treating Sawyer. This seems more like outright abuse.
Yeah, and I also wonder why the reveal needed to happen, right? Because if the goal of the pacemaker was to have him subjugated properly, maybe they thought, like, even if we revealed ourselves, he'd still be, you know, a good prisoner. That'd still be a huge, huge gamble. Out of pure rage, he could just continue to beat on Ben Linus after that. I'm like, you son of a bitch. I nearly got killed. I nearly got beat up by yeah. Danny Pickett to death because I was afraid I was going to die. I mean, if it was a con, it was a con that lasted under 24 hours. And I guess maybe cons were more so used to, like, getting some sort of physical object out of them, whether it be money or a good or even a service or something like that. Whereas this is more so like coercing somebody into a very docile position, which we already saw happen with Jack in episode one in a very different way.
The great Stefan Johnson writes in and says, wow, Mike and Josh are fantastic together. Every scene with them was great. I wish we got more of them together. They each bring a unique style that really complement each other. Josh Holloway and Michael Emerson were good, too.
I didn't even realize that we have a Josh Holloway and Michael Emerson scene.
Yeah, isn't that good? Isn't
I feel like nice?
I am trying to think of how many times do we see
James Sawyer. I was about to ask
James
the same
Sawyer
question, because I know we asked that about Kate and Ben during Tale of Two Cities, and
they'll spend some time together in season four when Ben is part of Locke's
crew.
That's
right, because Sawyer's going to go off with him for some time in New Otherton. But I feel like, obviously, they're going to be separated for most of season five due to just the separate natures of everything. And when things come back together, I can't remember, because Sawyer ends up joining Man
well,
in Black for a while.
Well, I think that the final Ben beatdown of Lost, actually, unless you want to give points to the tree that levels him, which I think we should. I think that goes to Michael for sure, is Sawyer. Sawyer is going to clock him in the face in the finale. So they have some more moments ahead of themselves, including one in the very final episode of the whole show.
Well, this is a great, I guess, introduction. Again, it's weird because these two characters had seen each other beforehand, but this is just such a great move where the person who seemingly has had some of the biggest power on the island so far just gets completely dunked on by somebody saying, like, yeah, you thought Sawyer was one of the big enemies in Lost? No, sir. I am the big bad. In which then we will see the meme of, you know, him sitting at a church pointing a gun at Sawyer's back, only to find out that the man in black is also pointing a gun at Ben's back.
The great Ben Martell asks, is it art about the lightning rod?
That's a very subjective question. You know, you would
as his art.
Well, you would ask, like, Desmond did not put it up as an artistic piece, but does that by proxy still make it art? Is intentionality a key part of the art?
I don't know. It's a good question.
I guess the other question is, after the thing got struck by lightning, did they leave it there and have it be a true art installation? Do you think Desmond was inspired by Hurley's comment and decided to make a gallery in the middle of the camp?
Wow, Hurley's comment is like Haley's comment?
Yeah, I think so.
This is from a leftover from last week. We had some questions about how on God's green earth did these men survive the hatch imploding? And Jesse Camacho, the great Jesse Camacho, so many greats who listened to Down the Hatch, offered this explanation. At the beginning of season five, Pierre Chang explains that at the center of the island is a massive amount of electromagnetic energy that may allow Dharma to manipulate time. In the incident, they accidentally begin to release this energy. When the atomic bomb goes off at the very same site in 1977, Jack, Kate, Sawyer, Juliet, Hurley, Miles, Jin, and Saeed are all teleported harmlessly back to the present timeline. Even Juliet, who had an atomic bomb detonate in her face, succumbs only to the injuries she endured by falling down that massive tunnel. All of which is to say, I believe something very similar happened in Live Together, Die Alone. Locke, Echo, and Desmond were unharmed in the hatch implosion because they traveled through time to one day in the future because of this same electromagnetic energy. Jesse, I'm buying it.
But why was Desmond naked?
Yeah. This looked great.
I think I saw someone say something like jokes. Because there was the room, there was a rumor apparently at the time that because Desmond's clothes were like synthetic, aka from non-natural materials, that the electromagnetism dissipated them, which is an
amazing.
I don't know, but from that logic though, if anything non-natural on Desmond is gone, does that mean his fillings are gone?
Yeah, his fillings are hurt. What from the Jim Fells music world do you want to discuss?
A couple of things. Just lots of Sawyer stuff, obviously. You know, there's a lot of like beating the crap out of someone music that comes in during the picket stuff, like when Mikhail beats up Kate in Enter 7-7, or when Locke beats up Mikhail in The Man Behind the Curtain. And also, we'll hear it again in the ultimate Ben beatdown in Through the Looking Glass. And Sawyer's little, like, vengeance motif that we heard all the way back in Outlaws finally comes back as Ben starts telling him about the pacemaker. I guess so it's that, I guess it came back around, Josh, literally. That
it'll come back
yeah,
around.
Yeah, that Sawyer's life is now on the line after he put Frank Duckett's back on the line. The music's there to show it.
How about that? How about that? All right, linked in our show notes, as always, from the great Jim Fells. So many greats. We mentioned the Ben Linus beatdown counter. Just to reset it so that everybody knows, in fifth place, coming in, debuting this week, it's Sawyer punching Ben in the mouth. In fourth place, it's Locke beating up Ben with a crutch. That's from Two for the Road. In three, it's Schrodinger's shelf, whether Ben is beating himself or the shelf is beating Ben. Either way, it's a beatdown that clocks in at third. Second is Saeed beating Ben up in one of them. And first, and still the leader on the board, is Danielle shooting a harpoon through Benjamin Linus.
I love that we've also called her Danielle. Like, we're on a first-name basis with her instead of Rousseau.
Yeah, we've gotten to know her a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, no? we'll find out much more about
her. I feel comfortable.
I feel like once we get to know young Danielle, then... And I feel like that's also two distinctly different people. Like, Danielle is the one in the expedition in Season 5, and Rousseau is who we currently know.
That feels fine. I'm fine with that. Let's talk MVPs, LVPs. I've got three MVPs. You've got two, you've got three LVPs, I've got two. I know that we're both simpatico on our first pick each, which is Jack. So 2 points for Jack this
week.
Yeah,
which makes him make up a little bit of ground from getting docked the first couple of episodes.
He's still at a -1 overall.
But this is a good episode for him. He was able to, you know, he got some walking time from his cartoons. He's able to, like, slowly get one over on Juliet, and he has some key information about somebody. I feel like Jack was sort of in a surprisingly dominant position in this episode, which he definitely hasn't been this season yet.
First appearance in Season 3, we're giving a point to Kate.
That's the first time in a while that Kate has got an MVP point.
First time in a while that Kate's got an MVP point. You know, the front runner for Season 1 for so much of it until Saeed got ahead. And Kate is now at 11 MVP points overall, tied with Jack at 11 MVP points. So the two of them are currently sharing fourth place.
Yeah, so we'll see. You know,
and I'm giving it to her. She gets out of the cage. That's impressive.
And we talked about, you know, how Season 2 is a bit disappointing for Kate. I'll be very intrigued to see where we go in Season 3 with that. This is her first point. We're going to get to her first big episode a couple of episodes from now, and so we'll see how that one holds up. In particular, I know that we are usually not kind on Kate in Kate flashback episodes, so this might be the best we see of her in this first little batch. I'm going to give a point to Ben Linus. You know what? Criticize him all you want as to whether or not this is a con, but considering what he's able to do, and especially that like little bonus point one-ups final scene with Sawyer, he's able to get a grip on one of the biggest con artists on the island, as he sort of shows him, I'm the true liar here, which I think is a big move and cements who Ben Linus is as a character to the rest of us.
I'm good with that. I am going to give a point to Desmond for using his future powers to save Charlie, and to build a lightning rod in such short order.
And create art, potentially.
and could potentially create art. And the fact that he is apparently a gifted golfer. I think we call him golfers.
What were
right?
you going to say? Golfist?
A golf person?
Nope, golfer makes sense.
Okay, we'll go with golfer. Not to be confused with Gawker. He's very good at that. So this is a great Desmond episode. I'm going to give Desmond a point. Look, we're not going to give Sawyer an LVP point this week. Josh Holloway, great performance. And, you know, he's very impressive in the prison flashback and his con job. But the dude gets convinced that he's got a bomb in his chest, and I think that that's not good
for
either.
Me, it's a big wash. Sort of like
it's a wash.
Sort of what happened 2 weeks ago, right? Where he, like, did something great and then got egg on his face. So, yeah, it's much like the bucket of water splashing all over him. It is a wash. Mm-hmm. So I have three LVP points. I'm going to give two to Danny Pickett. Just right off the bat, because he is an a-hole this episode. And look, yeah, it makes sense for him to go aggro after his wife dies, but Sawyer didn't do anything. So I think he's just a big old jackass in this episode. And I'm giving my third point to Munson, because he got conned. He got conned out of $10 million that he would have had had he, you know, been able to get out of prison.
He's a chump. I agree. I'll throw one at Munson as well. And this is the episode where Colleen dies. So as is not necessarily tradition, but as often happens, Colleen, for her death, shall receive an LVP.
I can't remember how many episodes we've done where, like, no 815ers have gotten LVP points. I'm assuming it's a good amount.
Yeah, probably.
Especially when you have episodes with, like, Anthony Cooper and Mr. Paik on it and Jacek McCormick.
None this week. 4.2 stars section, Mike. I gave the Glass Ballerina a 3, and I think Every Man for Himself is probably as good of an episode. Mm. I'm going to give it a 3 as well. I was going to try and see, like, can I tip it one way or the other? Is it slightly better, slightly worse? I think that they're probably about the exact same level of nothing burger for me. I think that there's maybe a little bit more to Every Man for Himself for the Sawyer arc. We get some Desmond time travel stuff, so that's fun. But I don't know that it's, like, marginally better than the Glass Ballerina. I think that they are about the same. I think that we are currently at like a level with the show where things are sort of, you know, hitting at this level right now.
Yeah, so I'm going to go a little bit above you, which I feel like is a rarity in our ratings here. I'm going to give it a 3.2, which tops out the scale of, you know, my good episode of Lost section of my rubric, where it's more good than bad, but not a lot of outstanding moments. Because I do agree that I think this has more to it from a subject perspective than the Glass Ballerina. As I said before, I think we move the chains forward with Jack as a prisoner, even with Sawyer as a character a bit, and we find out a bit more of just about how malevolent and Machiavellian Ben Linus can be. The flashback is just so floopy.
It's fine.
It's so inessential. Except for the fact that we find out that Sawyer has a daughter. They make nothing out of his time in prison, which could have been a really, really interesting way to go. If the con man's in prison, what's going to happen? Oh, he cons his way out of prison, sort of. I think they were really just, like, phoning it in, needed some sort of Sawyer plot to fill out this episode, and so they wrote something here. But I thought the stuff on the island was interestingly done, at least more well done than the Glass Ballerina. I sort of had this compared to, like, Everybody Hates Hugo, where, again, the flashback is sort of like nothing to do with, and the on-island stuff has interesting character moments with, like, a really, really good ending, and I gave that a 3.1, and I like this slightly better than Everybody Hates Hugo, so that ultimately gets a 3.2, and the audience, once again, say this again if you haven't heard it the past 3 weeks, Josh, is all over the map with Every Man for Himself, not as much as Further Instructions, but they basically range from, like, the high twos to even a couple of high threes, and that is going to average out to a 3.3 overall. So with your 3.0, my 3.2, their 3.3, that averages out to a 3.16. But Josh, I don't know if this is a low bar to clear, but this is currently the second best episode of season 3 so far.
Yeah, it won't stay this way.
Not even as soon as next week.
Look, I think that the four we've talked through so far, A Tale of Two Cities will stay pretty high. It's a 3.83. But the other three that we've talked about since, I think are going to remain, you know, they're going to be at the bottom of the barrel. I think that there are other episodes coming up this season that will contend with it. But I think that this will be lower tier stuff by the time we are through with season three. We are going to get into more Lost discussion in just a little while, in just a couple of days. An extra podcast coming your way this week before we resume our season three conversation proper. It's the 1 year anniversary of Down the Hatch. Wow. We are going to take a moment to pat ourselves on the back. Not like we don't do that every week anyway, but we're really going to do that this time. It's just that is the podcast. It's just self-congratulatory bullshit. So if that sounds fun to you, show up. And if not, skip it. But we're really excited about it. I think it's crazy that we've done this every week for a year. This is insane.
It is off the wall bananas. We've been here every week, not to mention the bonus podcasts we've done between, you know, the Lindelof, the two RPG podcasts, the two book club podcasts, freaking DJ Dom exposed party. So we're going to take a minute to lavish in it. You know what? Basically, yeah, this is going to be like a clip show. We're going to talk about some moments that you all picked out as highlights or weird lights from the previous however many episodes that we've done. I'd say it's been nearing probably what it's got to be at least 100 hours, if not more.
Easily, absolutely. I think that is, I don't want to do the math right now. Someone will have done the math, or we will have done the math by the time of that podcast. It's going to be many hours.
Yeah,
consumed by your ears if you've listened to everything, and that many more hours taken off of Mike's life and my life talking about
but
all this stuff.
But it's a good thing, you know? You're taking...
It's good.
Every moment takes something off our lives, but you want to spend it doing either good stuff or bad stuff, whether it means reading of mice and men or disturbing bunnies by going, hoppity hop, come on, hey.
Come on, hey. All right, so we've got some business to take care of with that 1 year anniversary show, and then we'll be back with the cost of living, the swan song, the Swan Station song for Mr.
God.
Echo.
I'm excited for that one, because I think that, you know, we've hit a mad to not so good streak of episodes after A Tale of Two Cities, but I think the cost of living is regarded as this and the Tale of Two Cities are going to be the two peaks in some of the valleys we're hitting here. Say what you want to about the weirdness of Mr. Echo dying in episode 5 of season 3. Josh, I know you've talked a lot about it, and I'm sure we're going to relitigate it, but it's a great episode. I am very, very excited to send off Mr. Echo to continue the stuff on Hydra Island, where Juliet goes full Love Actually here. Like, there's going to be a lot of great stuff coming up.
I think it's a controversial episode, so we'll talk about why as well. But I'm really pumped to talk about it. There's a lot in there that I've been excited to get into for a very long time. So this is a shorter podcast this week, clocking in under 2 hours. But I think that we're going to have a long one on cost of living. So get your feedback in. You still got plenty of time for that. We are back on track with your normally scheduled programming, starting with cost of living coming to your podcast feed on a Friday, August 21st. Send that feedback in down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. Tweet at us at postshowrecaps, at Round Howard, at A Mike Bloom Type. Subscribe to the podcast if you've not done so already. Check out everything we've got going on Post Show Recaps. There's a couple of things that are about to be popping up here that I think
popping
might
up.
Catch your ear. In addition to the Everything is Super podcast, the Marvel rewatch that we're doing, a couple of other podcasts that are popping up pretty soon. We will wait until those podcasts are in your feed before we shout them out directly. But it's going to be fun stuff. We're going to have a lot going on here on the podcast for the next little while. Anything else, Mike?
I don't think so. You know, this is a quick turnaround. I'm ready to have our own little flashback and pontificate before we move forward into, you know, the shape of things to come, in a manner of speaking, with the death of Mr. Echo, but a lot of other things being brought to life. As Josh, the other big piece of news is we are over halfway through what some consider the worst streak of episodes in Lost history.
Yeah, thank God.
It's been interesting to talk about. No matter what you say about the quality of episodes, it's led to some very fruitful discussions. And look, it has my favorite line of all of Lost in there. Can it really be that bad? Or is it like a red delicious apple that you throw on the floor?
How bad can that be? Yeah, is it red apple delicious trash? Or is it like actually delicious? You be the judge. All right, Mike. Well, then that's going to do it. We did it. Look at this. So what a plum job done by both of us. Is this an active kill, or are we going to be returning to every man for himself very often, or we think it's just gonna lie there?
It's tough to figure out what the active kill is before while the body is still bloodied. Plus, we have to realize if this is art, because if this podcast is indeed art, then we will be revisiting it many, many times.
I have an idea of how to make this art. You ready? Close out the episode by playing Ben screaming at the bunny rather than outro music.
All right, I got that. Let's have Benjamin Linus play this episode. Everybody hippity hops away from their podcast feed to come back in time for our 1 year anniversary.
What the hell?
Hey. Hey, come on. Hey, move. Let's move. Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on.
What are you doing?
Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Let's move it, let's move it, let's move it.
Hippity hop, hippity hop.
Let's move it, let's move it.
What's your problem?
Come on, come on.